the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast, where we discuss all things crypto related. Your host, Kieran Ryan.
Crypto is regulated by the Financial Sector Conduct Authority, but when it comes to shipping crypto abroad, there are gaps in the regulations. While the FSCA is able to monitor the conduct of crypto asset service providers operating in South Africa, the monitoring of cross-border trade is left to the South African Reserve Bank. The Reserve Bank's ability to monitor and regulate these cross-border movements of crypto is limited because they are not considered legal tender, and there are no specific regulations for cryptocurrencies. This means digital assets can be moved from local to foreign exchanges or into self-custody without restrictions, as local exchanges do not place a limit on how much can be shipped to destinations which may lie outside the country. There's also nothing to stop you taking custody of your crypto in a digital wallet and cashing that in abroad. This is the high-level picture. Of course, there are limits on the amount South Africans can externalize annually. That figure is 11 million rand for those using their full allowance under the single discretionary allowance and the foreign investment allowance. Now, there have been calls to relax or abolish exchange controls for all sorts of reasons, not least that they infringe personal property rights. Crypto has exposed many of these gaps in the law. We're joined now by Vihan Olafia, no stranger to the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast. He's a partner and head of fintech and digital assets at Forvis Mazar South Africa, and we're going to look into the legal and tax landscape governing cryptocurrencies. Hi, Vihan. Happy 2025 to you. You wrote an interesting article on MoneyWeb about the gaps in exchange controls when it comes to cryptos. For those who haven't read it, just briefly summarize what those gaps are.
Yeah, Kieran, thanks so much for having me on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast again. First one for 2025, and great to be back, of course. So the crux of the article that I wrote last year referred to the fact that there's been so much focus on the various tax implications from a cryptocurrency perspective and traders and investors that not sufficient attention has been given to the exchange control regulations that impact South African residents and taxpayers. So as you rightly pointed out, in South Africa, an individual is able to externalize a total of 11 million rand on an annual calendar basis, utilizing the single discretionary allowance and foreign investment allowances through the application on the SARS e-filing profile. The issue ever arises when individuals purchasing cryptocurrency on a local exchange and ship them off to another international exchange, utilizing the respective blockchains to facilitate this. Now, as you mentioned, as it currently stands, there's nothing wrong with this. Only when you purchase another foreign currency using your cryptocurrency does it result in an externalization event. So let me try and illustrate this. So the issue is when manual traders or trader using automated bots may purchase BTC locally and then send that off to a foreign exchange such as Kraken and then purchase US dollars and then use that US dollars to purchase Ether before sending it back to South Africa. That purchase of US dollars, even though it's being done for a couple of seconds or a couple of minutes or being used as a gateway to another cryptocurrency, will impact your allowance because what you're effectively doing is purchasing a foreign currency. So if I can maybe just try and explain that. So if you, for example, purchase BTC locally and then ship that BTC abroad and then use that BTC to purchase a US dollar-backed stablecoin like a USDC or USDT, and then back to Ether and bring it back to South Africa, that wouldn't have any implications on your allowances because it's not actually foreign currency that you're purchasing. So the possible transgression of exchange control regulation comes in where traders engage with arbitrage trading, where they, of course, deplete their full 11 million rand allowances, but forget to take into account the multinational trading activities where possibly foreign currency is being bought as part of their trading strategy. So the article therefore focuses on the fact that you need to understand the exchange control regulations and review and assess this holistically, taking into account all of your activities to make sure that there's not a specific transgression that you're involved with. So I was involved with two legal cases last year where the South African Reserve Bank investigated individuals based on their trading activities and possible transgression of these exchange control regulations. So it's become quite clear that the SARB has started to focus on these exchange control regulations, and therefore it needs to be top of mind for those engaging in these various activities. So the big question in relation to the article that I wrote is, how will exchange control regulations be adapted or applied to cryptocurrencies going forward? In addition to this, I asked the question, of course, how will this affect self-custody? And I think we'll probably address these questions during today's podcast, but that was effectively what the main focus of the article was.
All right. We'll get to that. I'm interested to hear about the court cases as well. But it seems that there are serious practical issues for the Reserve Bank monitoring these cross-border crypto flows. Even if we had tighter regulations, it would rely on the honesty of people reporting these transactions, would it not? You've mentioned the case of people that are shipping Bitcoin abroad, they're converting that into stablecoin, and they're converting that back into Ether. That's not, it seems, at the moment, a transgression of exchange control rules. So just talk about that. And, how does this get monitored, or does it rely on the honesty of people in reporting this to the Reserve Bank?
So this is where the issue comes in. Currently, the South African Reserve Bank does not integrate with cryptocurrency exchanges, meaning that cryptocurrency exchanges are not reporting to the South African Reserve Bank on a real-time or daily basis, as in the case with commercial banks or Adler license holders. This is, however, something that the South African Reserve Bank is looking to incorporate. And from what I can gather, there have been discussions between the SARB and some of these cryptocurrency exchanges and OTT desks to start this integration. There have also been discussions with the South African Reserve Bank and these cryptocurrency exchanges on the possibility of offsetting the inflow and the outflow of cryptocurrency. So effectively, if you're exporting cryptocurrencies to a specific medium, then importing those cryptocurrencies will effectively net off your allowances that is being utilized. Now, should cryptocurrency fall in the ambit of exchange control regulations and this is applied, then it might have a significant impact on the arbitrage market in South Africa as we currently know it. Now, currently, the process whereby the SARB is looking to prosecute individuals that have possibly contravened exchange control regulations is through a manual audit process. So effectively, they will go to these exchanges and ask for example, their top 10 clients by trading activity or trading volume and analyze that information. So and we need to appreciate, of course, the fact that exchanges and OTC desks are regulated in South Africa, and we fought extremely hard to get the industry regulator to protect those stakeholders. But with these regulations, it also brings a responsibility onto these exchanges where they're required to share information with these monitoring agencies. And I don't think there's a crypto asset service provider in South Africa that would be willing to put their neck on the chopping block for not obliging to these requests from the SARB or SARS. Now, another layer of complexity is that the South African Reserve Bank does not have access or legal overreach over these foreign exchanges to request the information directly from the source. So traders and investors would need to provide this information to the SARB as and when requested. So this does, however, pose a question of whether the SARB will be receiving valid, accurate, and complete information from those individuals being investigated. And the reason why I say this is people might be incentivized to manipulate those transactions or those data dumps obtained from the foreign cryptocurrency exchanges, which, of course, I would caution these individuals against, because you don't want to get caught up with the situation with the Reserve Bank. They do have certain mandates, for example, freezing your bank account for a period of 3 years, and that could create financial havoc for individuals. So it's best to be above board and to provide them with the correct and complete information. So I think in relation to the transactional data, just by looking at the send and receive data of the relevant foreign exchange, the SARB will also have extremely difficulty in identifying possible contraventions, because they will not be able to identify and definitively state that the cryptocurrency was used to purchase foreign currency abroad, still relying on those data sets that's being provided to them. So from where I sit, I think the SARB has their work cut out for them to address this going forward.
Okay, let's talk about these court cases that you were involved in. Just take us through what happened. You don't necessarily have to talk about the client specifically, but I'm interested to hear the details of the case.
Yeah, so this case, of course, is still ongoing, so I can't comment too much on it. But Effectively, what happened is that the South African Reserve Bank obtained information from some of the prominent South African exchanges, and then through the use of analytical tools, they concluded, and I'm not saying that their conclusions were correct or right, that there were instances where an individual externalized funds outside of his or her allowances. Now, just maybe just to break it down in the form of an example, you get instances where individuals want to buy Bitcoin at a specific price on a peer-to-peer trading platform as opposed to an exchange or OTC desk. And let's say this individual wants to buy 4 Bitcoin, for example. Now another individual, let's call him or her the facilitator, may want to fulfill this request. That facilitator would then source Bitcoin from multiple sources in South Africa to build up a balance the purchaser effectively wants to buy, which is the 4 Bitcoin. Now, for the sake of this explanation, let's take self-custody out of the picture and assume the facilitator was merely using local exchanges to action these transactions. Once the entire balance has been built up that the purchaser wanted to purchase, the individual facilitating the transaction will be paid in South African rands, and then the person facilitating the trade would send the Bitcoin to the purchaser's address of their choosing. Now, the issue is this. How do you know that the address, the Bitcoin you, or let's say, how do you know that the address you're sending the Bitcoin to is not perhaps held by a person in the United States that is a resident there, that's domiciled there? The next question is now is this an externalization event? Because it's not currency being moved from South Africa to the United States. Now, to further complicate the matters, is the South African Exchange Control doesn't only speak about the externalization of capital. It also speaks about a right to capital, which may include cryptocurrencies. And once again, if you think about it, all of these laws and regulations were brought out without the asset class in mind. So it's interesting how they apply these, let's say, these specific definitions onto blockchain-based digital assets. So if you were able to argue that the Bitcoin is deemed to be a right to capital, who is responsible for that externalization event? Is it the buyer who's giving the instruction, the facilitator who is taking the instructions from the buyer and giving the instructions to the exchange, or the exchange that's executing that transaction based on the instructions received from the facilitator? Now, you could look at it from a perspective that the buyer knew who he or she was sending the funds to. So they should probably be the responsible party, because neither the exchange nor the facilitator can definitively prove, even with the use of analytical tools, that the address to which the funds are being sent is outside of the borders of South Africa or controlled by a foreign individual or foreign entity. In addition to this, you also need to think about the nature of blockchain-based digital assets and where Bitcoin is actually held, which is, of course, on a series of nodes or records around the world facilitated by the internet. So there's no physical presence tied to a jurisdiction. It's actually on the internet. So technically, the Bitcoin being bought was never in South Africa to begin with. So how can you see this as an externalization event if it moves from one wallet or one address on the specific blockchain facilitated by the internet, as opposed to moving beyond the constraints of a specific jurisdiction? Now, there are two court cases that will probably be finalized this year and will most likely set the precedent of how the movement of cryptocurrency across borders will impact exchange control regulations. And of course, I think from that perspective, how they will bring these regulations into the environment of blockchain-based digital assets without, of course, stifling that innovation, but also making sure that they are acting appropriately and above recourse.
Interesting. Cryptocurrencies and stablecoins are designed to move around the world at speed. And will governments fail in trying to regulate this? This is not just a problem for South Africa. I mean, there are peer-to-peer exchanges like Vexel.it where you can buy and sell Bitcoin anonymously. That's what they're designed for. Same with decentralized exchanges, and there are many of them. It seems whatever regulations are in place, the technology is always going to be one step ahead of it. So how do governments get on top of this?
You're correct. I think there's various gaps and issues that regulators need to try and address if they want to further regulate the industry. And we see this happening with new regulations being developed in the United States. as well as Europe and with MiCA to address this, specifically in relation to decentralized finance. But as long as you have these decentralized finance platforms, it will create headache for regulators. There's no doubt about that. Because once again, these DeFi solutions are usually executed as a smart contract on a blockchain, which means that it's not tied to a specific jurisdiction per se. It's housed again on the blockchain that's dispersed over multiple nodes around the world. Now, how I see this playing out in South Africa, based on the proposed changes to exchange control regulations, is that South African natural and non-natural persons will be able to buy and sell cryptocurrency on local exchanges. They will most probably also allow you to send to another South African regulated crypto asset service providers. But in the event that you want to send it to a foreign exchange, it will require you to provide the exchange with your single discretion allowance or your foreign investment allowance, AITs. Now, these crypto asset service providers will also be required to share information about the customer's utilization of allowances to ensure that externalization events are not duplicated over multiple exchanges. And they might be able to piggyback a little bit off of the travel rule to facilitate that. But effectively, what they want to try to avoid is an instance where you externalize 11 million rand on Luno and another 11 million rand on Valor and another 11 million rand on Altcoin Trader. So these exchanges would need to speak to each other in terms of the possible transgression of exchange control limitations. So in my mind, these externalization events on local crypto asset service providers will include the event where you decide to move your cryptocurrency from exchange to a self-custody solution, because you can very easily move all of your cryptocurrency to a self-custody solution like a hardware wallet and offload the funds in another country using a foreign exchange, OTC desk, or peer-to-peer platform. Now, the issue with self-custody is it's that the non-natural person, such as a trust, won't be able to self-custody because trusts aren't allowed to hold foreign assets. Same applies to companies as well. Companies aren't allowed to go out and just purchase foreign currency unless they're usually rendering goods or services which they've been paid for in a foreign currency. So from a practical standpoint, where funds are moved from one crypto asset service provider to another, this will have some challenges as it would require the crypto asset service providers to share the receiving addresses amongst each other to ensure that the addresses are in fact from a South African source, which is further complicated based on the fact that exchanges can create Bitcoin addresses at a whim, which of course are linked to extended public keys, or Ethereum, where they use smart contracts to facilitate the tracking and the receipt of deposits before it's stored into an omnibus account, which may require exchanges to share information in a real-time basis, or if there's only shared on a daily basis, it might impact the speed of the initial transaction. So, but of course, I think if you have a situation where address is whitelisted and the other exchange, the sending exchange, is comfortable that the receiving address is linked to another crypto asset service provider in South Africa, that process will effectively be streamlined. But you might have an instance where you want to send funds from Luno to Valor, but now you're creating this receiving address and Luno might not have that on the list of addresses. I do appreciate the fact that some of the exchanges doesn't allow you to send, let's say, cryptocurrency for a 24-hour period prior to the address being created. So it might not affect it, but it is something to look at going forward as well. I think from another element maybe just that's worth discussing is if you throw DeFi into the mix. So it might require some head scratching from the regulators. But if you think about it logically and think about the externalization event, which of course needs to be approved by the crypto asset service provider, that has already taken place once it reaches a DeFi platform, and therefore there's no further requirement to track the funds to ensure exchange control regulation compliance. So let's say, for example, you purchase Ether on a local crypto exchange in South Africa, and you want then to participate in a automated market maker protocol on the Ethereum blockchain. You would send that Ether out from your South African exchange, but of course you would need to prove that it is within your allowances. Effectively, once you've proven that and it hits the DeFi platform, it's fine. Any subsequent profits being generated from there wouldn't contribute to the utilization of your allowances because you've already utilized it to a certain extent when you send that Ether to the DeFi platform. And this is where it might get a bit tricky is, as I mentioned, you might have instances where you've previously externalized funds and you reintroduce those funds into South Africa to be offset against an initial externalizations I mentioned. So you might have those instances going forward once the SARB and these cryptocurrency exchange have discussed it thoroughly and to make sure that these exchanges can adhere to these reporting requirements from the SARB. And I think it goes without saying that this will be an interesting problem to solve for the SARB. But as any regulating agency, I think they will take their time to try and best approach this to make sure that everything, as I mentioned, is done above board and of course, with reproach.
It does seem to be a serious issue that the Reserve Bank is facing, and it's technology which has really exposed these sort of regulatory gaps. And it does, in a sense, reinforce this call that has been going on for decades. Does South Africa need exchange controls, or does it need exchange controls to the extent that we have them and these limitations, 11 million rand a year? You know, going back 20 years, 11 million rand seems like a lot of money. It's not today compared to what it was. And maybe it starts stimulating a debate like that. You know, do we really need these kind of exchange controls at all? What's your opinion on that?
Yeah, I think if you think about exchange control in general, is why they've been implemented and what is the rationale for them being there? Is it to protect the fiscal policy of the government at the end of the day? Because if you think about it, the last thing that you want is funds just freely flowing out of South Africa and not kept within the borders of South Africa to actually stimulate the economy in South Africa. So to a certain extent, I can understand and I can appreciate the fact that these limitations are in place. And I probably just need to put the caveat there in as well. So you have your single discretion allowance, you have your foreign investment allowance of 11 million, but you can at any given point in stage go to the South African Reserve Bank and you can apply for a further additional amount that you're able to externalize with their approval. However, in practice, that has proven a little bit difficult when we have had clients that want to externalize beyond the 11 million rand. So it is a bit of a balancing act that the government is trying to implement with exchange control regulations. And I don't think the abolishment of exchange control regulation in its entirety will be necessarily a good thing for the economy. But, I mean, the people making the decisions need to weigh up all the options, including the various applications from a blockchain-based digital asset perspective. And, of course, that speaks to the possible implementation of this offsetting as well that they're looking to introduce.
Finally, Vihan, and just very briefly, we are running out of time. Just turning to tax for a minute, is there any further guidance from SARS, from the South African Revenue Service, on the treatment of crypto from a tax point of view? We have general guidelines, but have they got any more specific, and what kind of guidance do you think we should be expecting from them?
Yeah, so this is a sad thing. There's been no further authoritative guidance from SARS in relation to the treatment of cryptocurrencies from an income tax or capital gain perspective or in general. And this is a major problem because if you look at things like gains from cryptocurrency trading, can either be taxed as income or capital, and most people want to opt for capital as there's low rates being applied to you that you're taxed on. The problem is that SARS merely stated that the normal rules apply to cryptocurrency, but if you're applying those normal rules, specifically looking at the fruit and tree principle, these gains on cryptocurrency trading will in limited circumstances actually be deemed to be capital in nature. In addition to that, there's also this misconception that you hold your cryptocurrency for a period of 3 years is deemed to be capital in nature. That three-year rule, of course, only applies to Section 9C of the Income Tax Act that applies to listed securities, which doesn't include cryptocurrencies. So you would want some sort of guidance that we see in the US when you hold asset or let's say cryptocurrency for a period of 1 year, it's deemed to be capital in nature. So maybe a discussion for another day, but if you maybe invested into Bitcoin through a listed spot ETF, hopefully we'll see one in South Africa this year, you would be able to apply that Section 9C. But of course, it all depends on the taxpayer's entire portfolio. And of course, to add to the confusion of it all, specifically relating to capital versus income, SARS is also giving you the ability on your eFine platform to say whether your gains are capital, income, in nature. So without this authoritative guidance and the ability to choose either or, it feels like a little bit of a trap, and that makes me uncomfortable. And we also saw SARS at the end of last year issuing thousands of love letters to taxpayers that have previously discussed some of the disclosed some of their gains or losses in their historical tax returns. So now SARS are asking these individuals for supporting third-party data to substantiate these gains or losses in their historical tax returns. So basically, they're asking for a transaction dump of all the trades executed on local and foreign exchanges. Now, the question is, what will SARS do with that data? Because they've got no way to prove that the information received from the taxpayers is valid, accurate, and complete. Maybe from a local exchanges, but I mean, that's a vast amount of data. Now, in addition to this, they would need very impressive tools to reconcile the transactional data from local exchanges, foreign exchanges, decentralized finance exchanges, in addition to self-custody. And to add some flavor to it, you might have taxpayers that's trading on leverage or trading derivatives on these specific exchanges, or using automated bots to execute thousands of transactions on a daily basis. And I mean, being an auditor at heart, I'm very curious to understand what exactly will SARS be doing with the data once received, if any, because trying to audit these data dumps without the use of specialized tools will become an extremely impossible mission.
Fascinating stuff. We're going to leave it there. That was Vihan Olafia, who's partner and head of fintech and digital assets at Forvis Mazars South Africa. Thanks very much, Vihan, for joining us.
Thanks, Kieran. Appreciate the time.
Thanks for listening to the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast, hosted by Kieran Ryan. To listen to our other podcasts, go to moneyweb.co.za or the MoneyWeb app and follow MoneyWeb News for daily updates.